If there is fraud, candidates and their followers can go to the Election Complaints Commission and register their complaints.
Vote counting is underway in Afghanistan's presidential election. It's Monday, September 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, sending your mail may cost more. Growing Indonesian unrest. The process of removing a U.S. president. A top military leader retires. And lawmakers play football. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Afghan officials are counting votes after Saturday's presidential election that was held amid repeated threats by the Taliban and fear of post-election chaos. Better performance by electoral and security authorities notwithstanding, fears remain that disagreements on the result might engulf the country into a destabilizing fight for power. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Kabul.
Empty polling stations and empty ballot boxes. These were the scenes VOA teams found in the capital, Kabul, and many parts of the country Saturday. Unofficial estimates indicate the voter turnout will be a historic low. Extreme threats from the Taliban, voter dissatisfaction with candidates, and confusion over whether the twice-delayed elections will be held this time kept campaigns from gaining steam. Now that they are held, given Afghanistan's track record, many fear a dispute over results that could devolve into a full-blown crisis. Some candidates, like former warlord-turned-politician Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, seem to already be preparing for such a scenario.
The elections will result in increased violence. No one will accept the results other than those who were involved in widespread fraud. Naturally, it will result in a crisis.
The process of counting votes in Afghanistan is long. Ballot boxes have to arrive from far-off places with little or no communication lines. The preliminary results are not expected for a few weeks. Only then will they get to any complaints.
The law is very clear. If there is fraud, candidates and their followers can go to the Election Complaints Commission and register their complaints. The commission will decide upon them, and we are committed to abide by its decision.
Despite the introduction of more robust systems this time around to avoid fraud, including taking fingerprints and pictures of voters, allegations of fraud have already emerged from certain quarters. If more voices join ranks, this could wreak havoc to an already fragile system. Both election and security officials insist that they're ready to deal with any scenario, and everyone is hoping for a smooth transition. But Afghanistan has a long history of post-election chaos. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. More violence grips Hong Kong ahead of China's National Day. China to send top trade negotiator to U.S. for talks. Bus collision kills 36, injures 36 in eastern China. China awards national medals and honorary titles. Shoes and clothes made in Vietnam? Try phones and PCs. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The Universal Postal Union is warning of a major disruption to the global postal system and huge price hikes for consumers if the United States withdraws from the UN organization. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the UPU is trying to prevent this from happening.
The Trump administration's threat to withdraw from the UPU has triggered this extraordinary Congress. Washington is angry that China, considered a developing country, pays lower postal rates than the U.S. UPU Secretary General Bashar Hussein says the meeting seeks to find a compromise solution to keep the U.S. within the Universal Postal Union.
The U.S. is a very major player of the union. The economy is very big, and many countries have a huge traffic postal and packets traffic with the United States. So a departure of the United States from the union would mean then it's a total disruption of the service to that country. Because the moment a country leaves the treaty, what happens is that that country does not exist for us in our global postal territory.
Three different proposals are on the table. The United States favors option B, which would allow countries to immediately self-declare their own rates. Assistant to the President and Director of the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, Peter Navarro, heads the U.S. delegation. He agrees this option might cause some very short-term disruptions, but he says it is the fairest and quickest path to a reform that is long overdue. Hussein says he prefers another, more balanced proposal that allows nations to set their own postal rates at a slower pace. He tells VOA there will be negative consequences for the U.S. if it leaves the Union. He warns it will not be cost-free.
The moment a country walks away from a treaty, the Universal Postal Union, all the services and all the standards and the rules that govern the international mail supply chain system we have developed over the 145 years will no longer be accessible to them.
He says a country that leaves the treaty will no longer be able to exchange any letters, packets, or parcels using the Union's postal code and system. Hussein says the United States will have to negotiate different bilateral agreements with 192 countries. He says countries may have to use other channels to deliver the mail to the United States at higher rates. He adds it is the consumer who will have to pay. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, protesters and police clashed in Hong Kong for a second straight day Sunday, throwing the semi-autonomous Chinese territory's business and shopping belt into chaos and sparking fears of more ugly scenes leading up to China's National Day holiday this week. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to start off a brand new week with you here on VOA Asia. Indonesia's two easternmost provinces of Papua and West Papua, known internationally as the Territory of West Papua, have recently been racked by an elevated level of civil unrest. Thousands of people across the region have joined rallies to protest racial discrimination. VOA's Alam Bernahan looks at the root of the conflict.
On August 17, Indonesia's Independence Day, a group of Papuan students in the East Java city of Surabaya were allegedly taunted and attacked by a mob chanting racist slurs. The mob accused the students of desecrating an Indonesian flag. 1 year before, on December the 2nd, 2018, the Indonesian government blamed members of the military wing of Papua's separatist movement for the deaths of 19 workers on a new Trans-Papua Highway project. The roots of this latest conflict are as old as Indonesia.
The inhabitants of this...
Indonesia declared independence from the Netherlands in 1945, but the western half of New Guinea, also a Dutch colony, was not immediately incorporated into the Republic of Indonesia. In December 1949, at the end of the Indonesian National Revolution, the Netherlands agreed to recognize Indonesian sovereignty over the territories of the former Dutch East Indies, with the exception of Western New Guinea, which the Dutch continued to hold as Netherlands New Guinea. The Dutch agreed to relinquish the territory to temporary United Nations administration, signing the New York Agreement, which included a provision that a plebiscite would be held before 1969. The Indonesian administration, supervised by the United Nations, organized the Act of Free Choice in 1969, which was supposed to allow every Papuan to vote for independence or incorporation into Indonesia. Instead, a group of 1,025 voters were handpicked by Indonesian authorities, and their votes were recorded as unanimously in favor of integration. The area has been a hotbed of separatism ever since the contested vote. But despite the difficulties in the region, Indonesia's Western Papua is incredibly valuable to Indonesia, in part because of its natural resources. It's home to the Grasberg mine, the largest gold mine and the second largest copper mine in the world.
Of overall reconstruction in this territory.
In an effort to gain control of the region, the Indonesian government transmigrated tens of thousands of Javanese and Sumatran people into the region in the 1970s and 80s. That controversial practice was ended in 1990. In 2000, the province of Papua obtained what's called special autonomy status under the Abdurrahman Wahid administration. The administration restored the name Papua to the region, replacing the previous name, Irian Jaya. But a significant number of Papuans still support complete independence from Indonesia. By March 2019, Indonesia's national poverty rate is 9.41% of population. Papua's poverty rate is 27.53% of population. Despite its massive natural resources wealth, the Indonesian part of New Guinea, Papua, and West Papua province has serious poverty issues due in part to the government's focus on Java and neglect on Western Indonesia during the 1960s. From Papua, Alam Burhanan, VOA News.
Coming up, impeachment. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia, a growing number of experts, most recently from the UN, say Malaysia's official numbers miss millions of people who would qualify as poor almost anywhere else. At 0.4%, Malaysia has the lowest self-reported poverty rate among World Bank figures. Neighboring Thailand claims an 8.6 poverty rate. Anyone can have a wealth of news by visiting VOA Asia Facebook each day. As VOA Asia continues, Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced last week a formal impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. constitutional process whereby Congress may remove a president from office. 173 House Democrats are now calling for an impeachment inquiry. Following whistleblower allegations, President Trump pressured the Ukrainian president to investigate political rival Joe Biden's family, which could possibly help Trump's 2020 re-election bid. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has details.
A majority of the House now backs impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump.
This particular incident, I think, takes us to a different level because it's happening in real time. Americans can see exactly what is happening. And it's not just Ukraine, by the way. I mean, I think that people need to understand this is an overall issue of national security with all of the countries that we have relationships with.
Six House committees are at work on investigations. They can send their strongest cases to Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler, who can then recommend a full House floor vote on articles of impeachment.
Certainly by the end of the year, but the Speaker has said it has to be expeditious. The country wants us to move on this.
Pelosi's announcement prompted Trump to say she had lost her way.
Nancy Pelosi, as far as I'm concerned, unfortunately, she's no longer the Speaker of the House.
The White House release of the summary of the phone call between Trump and Zelensky split Capitol Hill along familiar party lines.
If you're looking for a circumstance where the President of the United States was threatening the Ukraine with cutting off aid unless they investigated his political opponent, you would be very disappointed. That does not exist. So from my point of view, to impeach any president over a phone call like this would be insane.
But the head of one of the investigating House committees said the intent in the call was clear.
What those notes reflect is a classic mafia-like shakedown of a foreign leader. They reflect a Ukrainian president who was desperate for U.S. support, for military support to help that country in a hot war with Putin's Russia.
Schiff will chair a hearing Thursday with Acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire to examine the administration's delay in handing over the whistleblower complaint to Congress. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Trump is now only the fourth U.S. president to become the subject of an impeachment inquiry. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone tells us history shows that the politics of impeachment are complicated and risky, and the eventual outcome and fallout are often hard to predict.
Donald Trump is now fully engaged in a battle to save his presidency.
What these guys are doing, Democrats are doing to this country, is a disgrace, and it shouldn't be allowed. There should be a way of stopping it, maybe legally through the courts.
Trump is rejecting a charge from Democrats that he abused the powers of his office by seeking Ukraine's help to find damaging information about one of his Democratic rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden. Democrats point to a whistleblower complaint that detailed Trump's attempt to get help from Ukraine and alleged White House efforts to cover it up. Democrat Adam Schiff chairs the House Intelligence Committee.
And if, as alleged, if, as this record of call already indicates, the president was, instead of faithfully executing his office, was using that office as leverage to obtain dirt, to have another country manufacture dirt on his opponent, it is hard to imagine a more fundamental abuse of that office.
For the most part, Republicans continue to back the president. The political impact of an impeachment battle during a presidential election campaign is hard to predict, especially on some of the president's supporters, says analyst William Howell.
Are they then going to rally behind the president? That's certainly what Trump is banking on. He's going to do everything he can to elicit that kind of response by members of his own party.
Democrats may also be mindful of what happened with the impeachment of President Bill Clinton in 1998.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Clinton lied about and tried to cover up his affair with intern Monica Lewinsky, which led to his impeachment by the House. Clinton remained in office after he was acquitted in a trial in the Senate, and Republicans lost congressional seats in the 1998 elections in the resulting political backlash. In 1974, Congress began impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon over the Watergate scandal.
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Nixon left office when it became clear that he would likely not survive an impeachment trial in the Senate. What comes next for President Trump is uncertain, but both sides appear to be preparing for a long and divisive political battle with an uncertain outcome. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia, prominent Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong announced plans to contest local elections and warned that any attempt to disqualify him will only spur more support for months-long pro-democracy protests. The 22-year-old Wong said he will run in district council elections in November. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, General Joseph Dunford, the nation's top general as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is leaving office today. As VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports, the top military advisor to the president will be remembered for a number of things, including his efforts to strengthen the military amid growing tensions with Russia and China.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
General Joseph Dunford led the military under two very different presidents, garnering respect from both sides of the political aisle and from military experts.
I think General Dunford has been one of the best chairmen we've ever had,
and it's not always easy to measure by the state of the world.
The general is retiring amid increased tensions with Iran and rising violence in Afghanistan.
When I think about Afghanistan, I think about two things. Number one is we don't want Afghanistan to be a sanctuary from which the homeland can be threatened, the American people and our allies can be threatened. And the other is we want peace and stability in Afghanistan for the Afghan people.
Ensuring these objectives strained negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban. Dunford has pushed throughout the process to make sure the military can still take out terrorists there, despite President Trump's desire to pull some troops out of the country.
The president and the secretary have been quite clear to me that as this progresses, we're going to ensure that our counterterrorism objectives are addressed. And so I think it's premature. I'm not using the withdrawal word right now.
In the Middle East, Dunford led the charge that crushed the Islamic State caliphate in Iraq and Syria.
If you go back 4 years and you look at the difference in terms of the presence of ISIS and what they had achieved then and where they are today, certainly there's been progress.
And experts like O'Hanlon credit Dunford's calm, steady leadership with keeping the U.S. out of a conflict with North Korea.
We went through 2017, the locked and loaded fire and fury, my button's bigger than yours, all that brinkmanship needed to be survived and be prevented from taking us into war. And I think Dunford had a role in that as well.
While the United States remains entangled in conflicts, most agree the American military is stronger under his leadership, modernizing and growing in an effort to stay ahead of great powers Russia and China. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
It's football season here in the United States, a joyous time when millions of fans cheer on their favorite college and professional National Football League teams. One football contest takes place just once every other year. It's the Democrats versus the Republicans on the field for a charity congressional football game. Together with former NFL professionals, lawmakers play against the U.S. Capitol Police, and politics, for a change, stays off the field. Daria Digets talked to some of the players after the game.
On this day, there is no such thing as partisanship. Once every 2 years, U.S. lawmakers come together on a football field for a charity congressional football game against the U.S. Capitol Police team.
Oh, I mean, we're here to win. Yeah, but we're going to have fun while we're doing it.
By mutual agreement, politics stays on the sidelines, even though this year's match took place just hours after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that House Democrats were moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. This annual match first took place in 2005 when lawmakers' team Mean Machine and the Capitol Police, or the Guards, hit the gridiron to support the families of two slain police officers. Both acting and former lawmakers take part in the game together with former NFL professionals. There was a lot on the line. Congress has not won on this field since 2009, and the Capitol Police want to keep their streak going.
The second game now, I'm kind of used to a little more, but it's definitely a physical game out there. It raises good money for some good charities, have police funds, military funds. You know, it's a big environment. It's becoming a bigger event.
At halftime, Congress is up 8-4. And even a day of political turmoil could not spoil the mood.
We got to work together where we can, and I think we got to get past this hate and vitriol, because our country needs the two parties to work together.
Democrat Tom Malinowski, despite supporting the impeachment idea, also voiced hope that lawmakers will find common ground and work together.
But we get some bipartisan work done, and these things help because we get to know each other better, we become friends. It's easier to find common ground on the other issues.
Lawmakers won with 14-4. The funds raised during the game will be passed on to the families of policemen who die on duty, children of the military and low-income families. Daria Digutz for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. No matter how you've heard our program today, you can find us many different ways, especially online. You'll find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, where you can hear and download our program if you like. You can also hear us on the radio throughout Asia. Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia carries our program, and we'd like to say hello and thanks to everyone there who listened today. You can also send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. voaasia@voanews.com is our address. We send thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Carl Starling, our managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.